Blog Talk Radio.
Firefly Willows LIVE presents Revolution, featuring your host, Heisi Lutmers.
Introduce a process that you fellow listeners can try at home as well, and I would encourage you to do this. And we're going to allow the universe to give us our topic and pass on whatever messages we need to be hearing at this moment. So we're going to use bibliomancy, which is a oracular or divination system using books. And the process we are going to follow is each of us have a book. We're going to randomly open the book, look to the left-hand side, find the fourth sentence down, and whatever that fourth sentence is going to be the message, the theme, the topic, the point of discussion that we and everyone listening needs to hear at this moment. And if you want to do this at home, you can follow that actual procedure, or you can close your eyes, open the book, and open your eyes and wherever your eye falls, or you can place your finger down and then open your eyes and see what sentence your finger is on. But it's a really interesting way, I think, to ask a question, receive a message, receive guidance, especially if you don't work with other tools like tarot or astrology or something. Pretty much everybody has books, and we can often be surprised at what can come from those books, even from a sentence. And I would encourage you to try this. So, having said that, are all of my co-hosts ready and prepared?
Ready, yes.
Ready to go.
All right. So I think that what we will do is we'll honor the balance of energies, and we'll go female, male, female, male. So, Mildred Lynn, would you be willing to start us off?
Sure, I'd be happy to.
All right.
I recently moved to Sebastopol, California, so my books are in storage. So I ran out into the garage and picked one up on body language. I opened it up. I went to the left-hand side of the page. My eyes quickly went down to the fourth sentence, and it says this: establish immediate eye contact. Maintain periodic eye contact, but do not stare. So it's in the context of body language, appropriate body language.
So if you just take that particular statement, how would you interpret that? What message do you feel that that has if that was what you needed to pass on to someone?
For me, I've noticed over the last couple of weeks, and perhaps it's because I'm moving to a new area, when I meet people I don't know, even in a store or on the street, I find myself trying to catch their attention and look into their eyes. And when I look into their eyes, it's their being or their inner self that I want to connect to, and that I should put it this way, that there's an opportunity to connect to. So that's what I take out of that, how important it is when you meet another human being on your path, even during the day when you're doing mundane things, to take the time to establish contact, human being to human being, and you can do this by eye contact. It's very easy. Now, I had no idea about the do not stare part. Perhaps in my enthusiasm to connect, I may be staring at people. I'm not sure. I'll have to watch myself and record back.
Well, it might be saying that if we dwell on something for too long or too hard, we'll always find what it is that we think we're looking for in it rather than accepting what it is by simply seeing it as it is and then moving on. And people get stuck in their stories, in drama, in upset, in emotion by dwelling on it. And they keep looking at it rather than being able to just let it pass through so that they can move on from it.
Okay.
So, John, would you like to go next?
Well, let's see. One, two, three, four. I'm used to the way I am. I'm used to the way I am. I think this is the natural state of most of us, that we're used to the way we are, and that comes through habit and conditioning and and that's what makes us comfortable. And it's okay, I think, to be comfortable with the way you are, as long as it's not something that you hold on to so tightly that you can't allow change to move through you. You know, life is change. There's change. Change is all around us. So, I think what I'd be sharing with people is to look at who you are. Look at how comfortable you are with who you are and ask, is it a comfort that you feel is healthy, or is it a comfort that is simply there because you're used to it? And, you know, Aries is a sign of change. It's a sign of action and dynamism. And it's springtime where things are blooming and shifting and changing and mixing. So, you know, don't be afraid to mix it up a little bit. And if you're somebody who mixes it up a lot, because that's who you are and you're comfortable with that, maybe you got to think about not doing it. Because that's also being comfortable with who you are, being used to the way you are. So those are my thoughts.
And I think that it also speaks to what Mildred had, because if you're used to the way you are, that's because you tend to stare at yourself too much and you don't look at yourself in different ways or look at yourself through other people's eyes. You know, how often are people uncomfortable when somebody says, oh, you know, you're really great at such and such. And people think, oh, well, you know, I put on a good front. Or, you know, oh, you may think so, but I'm not really that good. But that's because they're used to seeing themselves in a certain way, but can't see how the other people are perceiving them, which can be positive.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Because we tend to stare at ourselves and get used to what we're looking at, rather than looking away or looking differently in order to not get stuck in that familiarity, that comfort zone that you were talking about.
Yeah, and I think, you know, with, you know, your show is called Revolution, which is about change, either dramatic or gentle, but it is about change. And embracing change and acknowledging that change requires something of us, even if it's just to be present for it and endure it sometimes. And holding ourselves back away from change because we're used to the way we are isn't necessarily the best way to serve ourselves.
So, Deb, would you like to go next?
Sure.
Just before he let himself slide into sleep, he thought he felt the very singing of the vacuum itself, not empty, but full of incredible potential, a ground on which the world was only lightly superimposed. From atoms to galaxies, it seemed as if it might all be swept away by a strong enough will. Well, I think probably the piece of this particular sentence that hits me the most is the when it speaks of the incredible potential that is all around us in the vacuum itself. There's so much more to everyone than what we are aware, than what is on the surface. And as you guys were speaking just a little while ago, even within ourselves, sometimes there's so much more that we're not used to seeing, that we don't take the time to look for. Something that I've noticed when I'm out and about doing my mundane things, when I stop and actually make eye contact with the person who's running the checkout, when I stop and make eye contact with the individual who has just handed me the bag or whatever, those few moments of making eye contact really take me outside of where I am right now. It seems that time stops and expands for a moment, and there's something that happens that isn't just, okay, hello, casual little conversation. Yes, I found everything I'm looking for. Thank you very much. I go on my way. There's really a moment that is full of incredible potential. There's more there than I would have had the opportunity to experience if I hadn't been open to it.
Well, I think just your description of it, Deb, for me, was a powerful one. It really is true when you actually stop to be in the moment, how much there is in the moment. We have our little program that we run, which is, okay, I'm at the checkout, I'm supposed to take my credit card out and swipe it and get my bags and walk away. And as long as we're operating from that program, we're actually not in the moment.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very sterile place to be, right? Compared to what it's like when you're actually in the moment and there's a person there and they have an interesting tattoo or they have an interesting ring or they have an interesting name and you engage them and all of a sudden you're in the present moment and it's like, wow, this is a cool thing to be. This is a cool place to be. The tenuousness of the reality we experience, which was cited in the sentence, that it could just be blown away, that it rests on this void that is so full of potential, and yet it is not, the reality we experience really isn't so concrete as we perceive it to be, was a piece that I connected when you told the story about, you know, being awake to the person in the checkout line. Because the fantasy that we live is not the reality we're in.
When I was listening to that, what came to me was a potential interpretation of the stare part of my little sentence, or my big sentence, depending how profound people find it. So the stare part, when I was listening to what you said, Deb, I noticed that when I establish contact or I try to establish contact, there's a split second where when the person recognizes and feels that they are being seen at a soul level. And the response to that is either to welcome that recognition or to become shy and bashful.
Yes.
But the step before that is always the recognition that they are being seen.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the opportunity, that's the seed. And more often than not, it's a smile greets you.
Right.
Like, I know that you have just looked at my soul, and it's a thank you. I feel seen.
Right.
I feel witnessed. And now we'll both go about our days, but we have that little bond there, or that little knowing.
Mm-hmm. That little tiny connection.
Yeah, connection point. And it's important, and I have no idea why it's so important, but I know it's very important for both of us.
Right, which is one of the things that I've always tried to be aware
and to be very conscious of my interactions with people in those public spaces, particularly people who are there to serve you. Their job is there to provide something for you. Waiters, service people, the attendants on the planes. I've always felt that it's part of my job is to actually make eye contact with them, to see them, not just accept the thing that they are doing for me and go on my merry way. So that the connection there is a very vital part of why I'm there at that moment too.
And I think it speaks to what John read. If we become too comfortable with who we perceive ourselves to be, we're missing out on a whole limitless possibility of potential that we could be because we keep ourselves very confined in that limited vision or perception that we hold on to or cling to. And it makes me think of, like, on reality shows, even when theoretically it's a whole bunch of real people brought together for something, they all fall into a particular label or stereotype. And so, you know, you have the villain and you have the geek and you have the this and you have the that. And so they're not allowed to be complex, layered people. They're simply one thing, and that's what they want us to perceive them, those people, as. And this, what you read, Deb, says, if you, and combine that with also Mildred's thing, if we take the time to look deeper, then we will see that there are unlimited layers of potential and possibility for who someone is and why someone may be crossing our path at any moment if we simply take the time to look and to see it.
Mm.
And Mildred's thing also made me think about something that we talked about with my guest on the Amethyst Historical last Tuesday. And that was about how people interact now so much on the virtual level that we've almost forgotten how to have interpersonal interaction. And Mildred's starting us off seemed to reemphasize the importance and how much we miss by not having face-to-face, eye-to-eye contact with people versus always doing it via email or text message or whatever Facebook, whatever virtual or digital means we may use. And those aren't bad, it's just that they seem to have, the balance has gotten out of whack.
And I guess there's no replacement for that human connection. That would be the other thing. It seems to be basic, intrinsic, like the trees that grow on the land. It's just part of what we are and who we are that nourishes us somehow.
Right. I mean, I can watch on the best high-definition television there is some travelogue show about a particular place, but that can't replace going there and actually experiencing what it's like to be in that place, to feel it under your feet, to breathe in the air there, to participate in the energy there. There's nothing that can replace that personal interaction with people or with places or whatever.
Hmm.
So now I shall read from mine.
All right.
And it says, joy, sadness, fear, and anger are the primary colors of our quilt that covers us with the subtle artwork of love, guilt, and compassion. And I think that's a nice reiteration or complement to the other things that have been read and been said here, because it reminds us that we're all a tapestry of emotions, characteristics, qualities, preferences. And if we stare too long, if you're looking at a quilt and you stare too long at one particular square in the quilt, you're missing out on all of the other context and all of the other artwork that's going on in that quilt. So if we stare at one aspect of a person, we miss out on all of the other range that makes that person who they are.
But if we look deeply into the eyes of that person, we see the whole quilt.
Right. And we see that each of us is a patchwork of many things rather than can be easily labeled or stereotyped or boxed in to one particular aspect or thing. And even with our emotions, if we remember that we have a range of emotions, sometimes we get stuck by staring at a particular emotion, you know. And how often do you hear somebody define themselves or describe themselves as, well, I suffer from depression, or, you know, I'm an angry person. But again, they're not allowing for that unlimited potential that they hold of being because they've gotten too comfortable as only seeing themselves in one way.
And I feel that human contact of being really seen, it's more foreign in people's lives than common.
Yes. And I've often tried to, like, if I pass a homeless person, to not avert my eyes, but to try to at least look them in the eye so that they are seen and acknowledged as an actual human being that is sitting or standing there rather than simply as a piece of furniture or a post that I simply walk by and don't even look at or notice.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah.
So thank you, everyone, for participating in this slightly unorthodox process compared to our normal roundtable. Hopefully it was enjoyable, and hopefully everyone listening found it both enjoyable as well as was able to perhaps glean something they needed to hear from what each of our books had to offer. And I thank Mildred and John and Deb for joining us today.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Yes.
Yeah. Thanks, Heidi. Have a great
Thank
show.
You.
Thank you, and stay tuned. We will be right back with more opportunity for you to join the revolution. So stay tuned.
Firefly Willows, LIVE, is proud to support Underdog Railroad Rescue, a pending 501c3 organization based in Portland, Oregon. Underdog Railroad Rescue works directly with rescue groups in Southern California to rescue dogs who are on their last days in the high-kill shelters. They foster the dogs until they are healthy, get to know the dogs' personalities and needs, and help them find their forever homes. Find them on Facebook at facebook.com/underdograilroadrescue or contact them at underdogrr@gmail.com. This tip of the week from Underdog Railroad Rescue. When you pick up your dog, be sure to ask about his routine while in foster care or at the shelter. Keeping his routine as similar as possible for the first few days will reduce stress. Slowly introduce new foods and your schedule for feeding, toileting, and play exercise. Your dog will need family time and brief periods of alone time. Give him attention for good behavior, such as chewing on a toy or resting quietly.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. Linda Wiley here with Living Well with Linda, your monthly guide to the well-being of your body, mind, and spirit. It's about an alternative approach to life, healing, and well-being in our changing world. We have forgotten much of the true meaning and value of food in our modern world. Hippocrates says it like this: let food be thy medicine, and medicine be thy food. So we shall honor food as this in our monthly chat. Today, we will continue on with our thoughts of spring, and this is an important time for the liver, as we have discussed in the past. So all of the suggestions in the food section here will be things that help the liver, because they're foods that grow in the time of spring. Foods grow in certain times that nourish and honor our bodies in that season. So liver is in the time of spring, lungs is fall, and so on like that. So spring is here. Buds are budding, blooms are blooming. It's a great time of year. Each season carries with it, as we have suggested, its deep message of health and well-being. And so it is that a new season begins, without as within. So how shall we hold it this time, and how shall we do it in harmony? We see that sprouts are coming up, and this should let us see that sprouts are for us as well. They are filled with all the life potential of this season, of this new life, which is what we're doing, is generating new life again out of the compost, composted during winter. So alfalfa seeds are great to use. They make sure they are organic. And clover, radish, onions, these are all good for sprouts as well. You can sprout some beans too. Lentils, red beans, garbanzos, great beans to sprout. Greens are all around us, so we'll keep adding them into our smoothies and our steamed vegetables in the evening and lettuces, so we can start having our salads with all manner of seasonal vegetables, which would be beets and celery and carrots. Snow peas are, and all peas are coming. I love them. Wonderful chives and all the herbs that we can add in. Wonderful things that support the whole body in all of its processes, and especially the liver loves green. So I would like to share a salad that I make. When I bring it, people love it. They always request me to bring it. My family always wants me to bring it to the potlucks, and it's called massaged greens. So you take your chard or kale, collard greens work, cut the center strip out, you take olive oil and salt, you drizzle the olive oil, sprinkle the salt, and massage it into the greens. It breaks down the fibers in there. Let it sit in the refrigerator for a little bit while it does its work, softening. And then you take and cut it up into small pieces. I add finely diced red onion, roasted red peppers, some Savoy cabbage. It kind of lightens up the color in there. And then I mix it all together. You add balsamic vinegar, more salt to taste if you like, and then feta cheese at the end, and mix it all up. And it's just fabulous. Another delicious thing at this time of year is cilantro. It loves cool weather like early springtime, and it is a wonderful herb that helps the body detox heavy metals. That would also support the liver in its process at this time. So I like to put chopped cilantro on top of my salads. I add it to a lot of things, and I make a cilantro pesto, which is a cilantro lime pesto, which is really delicious. And you just make it like pesto, but you add a less Parmesan and less garlic so it doesn't overpower the flavor of the cilantro. Add a little lime, blend it up. And then once you have it in your dish where you're going to store it, cover it with olive oil enough so that none of the pesto is showing, and it keeps it from oxidizing. Have fun. Be creative. It's wonderful. I made a tarragon pesto one time that was to live for, as they would like to say. Just fabulous. So have fun. That's what it's all about, really. Now I would like to turn to a bit of a heavier side, perhaps, or exploring some deeper truth behind food and what we see out in the world today, so that we can really know how to take care of our bodies and what we need to do and what we need to be careful of, and really how to look carefully at in the world at large. Because there's a lot of things to be aware out there in the world, because there's a lot of tricks and traps and a lot of veils that hide things. And if we're not aware of it, we get tricked into doing something that if we really knew about, we wouldn't participate. So we really have to be aware and careful out there in the world, because there's lots of things going on in the world that we need to be aware of. And we need to start connecting some of the dots to really look and see, like Monsanto and the GMO foods. We must learn about them. They're dangerous. They're killing bees. They destroy the soil, human organs. They're bad on the animals. It's a very serious situation. So we have to learn how to about what is real food and good food and what isn't, and to not support that which is life-threatening and life-destroying. So that's why this information is really important. And we have to learn to choose wisely out in the world and really read our labels and check on corporations and see who's supporting who. And it's time that we really learn to live in gratitude with compassion for ourselves, the earth, and each other. And so it is in this way that the new dream takes over as the old crumbles to the ground, for that which is not mutually beneficial shall perish. These are choices that we are all making at this time. What's yours? Will we make it? Life always survives, with or without us. These are some serious times requiring serious thought, deep looking, and wise action from an informed position. There's so much information out there available to us that if we're not using it, we're really putting all of ourselves in harm's way. It's important to be aware of what's happening out there. We have to remember that we have the power, and it's time to leave the victim mentality behind and be proactive. It really feels good. So my recommendation for this month would be to check out naturalnews.com and Mercola, that's MERCOLA.com. These are both really great alternative news sources for information about GMOs, the well-beings of our bodies and minds. Dr. Mercola is a doctor, very alternative, well-informed doctor, and Natural News is a alternative news source as well. And I have a couple of books to recommend that go along with what we were talking about. One is called The Holographic Canvas by Sonia Barrett. It's a wonderful view of the matrix from an awakened perspective, someone who looks and tells us about what's going on from her perspective. It's very interesting and worth reading, very enlightening. Another book along that line is called The Matrix Revealed and Escape from the Matrix by John Rappaport, because it's really time to take a look at our world and see what's really going on. And we're going to find out that it's not really what we thought it was. And it's really important that we see that it's not what we thought it was. So it might be scary at first to look and to really see that things aren't what we want them to be, but it's a must. It's a must. And we must learn to look within ourselves and see the dysfunctions that we hold there and the separations that we hold, and heal those so that we can come together in our common humanity and return the world to its truth. In regards to looking within and doing the work within, when we do that, we get into our interior toxicity. And certainly it is the liver that clears the toxins out of the body. So by supporting the liver to do its cleanse, it can also help the emotions release. But it doesn't mean that you don't have to do your work. Doesn't mean that you let that do that. You know, you also have to do the work. So again, those recommendations for this month was naturalnews.com, mercola.com, and the books are The Holographic Canvas by Sonia Barrett and The Matrix Revealed and Exit from the Matrix by John Rappaport. So that's our chat for today. Thank you for joining me for this segment of Living Well with Linda. I'm Linda Wiley. If you would like to chat further with questions, comments, or consultations, I certainly welcome that. Please contact me at linda@prestia.com. Thank you. Blessings to you all. Have a great rest of the day.
My revolutionary guest today is Christopher Penzack, a witch, teacher, author, and healing practitioner. His practice draws upon the foundation of both modern and traditional witchcraft, blended with the wisdom of mystical traditions from across the globe as a practitioner and teacher of shamanism, tarot, Reiki healing, herbalism, astrology, and Kabbalah in the creation of new techniques and traditions. He is the author of over 20 books, including the 6-volume Temple of Witchcraft series, and he travels extensively throughout the United States and the world, teaching witchcraft as well as offering online classes and lectures. Christopher Penzack is the founder of the Temple of Witchcraft tradition and co-founder of the nonprofit religious organization, the Temple of Witchcraft, located in Salem, New Hampshire. So please help me welcome to the Revolution today, Christopher Penzack. Welcome, Christopher Penzack, and thank you very much for joining us here on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, you're known as a rather prolific writer because you have at least over 20 books at this point that I think that you've written in, what, the past 5 years or something, it seems like.
I started writing my first book got published in 2001, and I think I'm on book 22 right now.
Wow.
When I'm writing, actually putting things in paragraph form, I always have a really clear theme going on. I usually don't write a book, and one of the things that makes it easier for me is until I taught the class. So usually anything I'm writing on, I've been teaching on for a little while, so I have notes from the class about what's worked for students, what hasn't, what are the questions people came up. I'll write them in the margins. I'll kind of put down notes of you know, what I told people at that time or what people seem to resonate with and make sense to them. And then I will take those notes and from that make an outline. And I have a lot of files that are just snippets of little things that I've read that I want to remember, or conversations I've had with people that, you know, were particularly illuminating that I'll kind of cut and paste out of my journal and put it into one of these documents. I try to organize them along with the class notes to kind of flesh out, you know, a deeper outline. And I really just try to write it like I'm having a conversation with somebody. So once I have the outline of what I'm going to go on, I would just teach it like I was teaching from an outline. And what would I say to this person? Instead of saying it, I just write it down.
And speaking of the books that you have now, a couple of years ago, you started your own publishing company.
I did, yeah. I'm very excited about it.
And you're now releasing all of your books through your own publishing company? Is that true?
That is the plan right now. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, we started up something called Copper Cauldron. And it's been nice because now I can kind of do all the books I want to do. Thus far, we've only been doing anthologies and compilations that have other authors in it, and those are going to be for fundraisers for the temple. And I figure once, you know, we have our eggs and our ducks in a row and our eggs all lined up, that we'll be able to figure out whether we want to take on other authors and, you know, work with other people as a full-on publishing company and be able to hire a staff and so. But right now it's just me and my two partners, Steve and Adam, that run it.
Is there a particular focus or theme in terms of the types of subjects and books that you envision that doing, or is it envision being much broader and having various types of topics and genres and things?
I think the overall, at least initial vision, will be what I would think of as metaphysics and occult. But I imagine we'd probably branch out into some holistic health and alternative kind of healing things, because that's something that also interests me too.
So speaking of books, I wanted to ask you about a few of your more recent publications. And one of those that I think came out, well, maybe it's been 2 years now, is The Three Rays of Witchcraft?
Yeah, that's been about 2 years ago, yeah.
Can you maybe just explain what you mean by The Three Rays of Witchcraft and what that book entails?
Sure. That was our first release on Copper Cauldron. And I really felt strongly about putting it out through someplace different, because it's not your typical very broad-based how-to book that a lot of people are looking for when they're just looking for something in witchcraft. It was very specific to what we're doing in the Temple of Witchcraft and a lot of the things that I teach, you know, people who study with me over the long term. It really combines the ideas of a witchcraft aesthetic and spiritual theology with a lot of the occult traditions of theosophy and the old ceremonial magic orders of like Dion Fortune and Aleister Crowley and those types of figures. And it really takes something that I wrote about in a more general way in a book called Ascension Magic, called The Science of the Seven Rays. The Science of the Seven Rays is really deeply involved in the Theosophical movement and the writings of Alice Bailey, and Dion Fortune talked about it quite a bit, although she used a little bit of a different system. But this idea that there's three primary rays and then there's four secondary rays, and they're kind of archetypal. They represent an energy, they represent an archetypal form, they're associated just like any magical system with the planets and the days of the week and various colors and gems and herbs. And what people like a rather occult system like to argue over which is the correct correspondences. But I ended up having a vision involving my own use of the seven ray system with witchcraft, because a lot of people don't necessarily connect the two of them. And in this vision, it actually took on the image of the druidic symbol of Awen, which looks like three dots with three lines kind of coming down almost vertically, surrounded by three circles. But my three lines were a little bit different. One was like a serpent that was horned, like a ram-headed serpent. Another one was a straight line, like a arrow or a spear. And then the last one was a curving branch. And in that image, it kind of brought together a lot of different teachings. So it brought together the theosophy, brought together a witchcraft saying about by a straight line, by a bent line, by a crooked line. And it's an author and podcaster named Peter Capadden who's made that saying pretty famous through his Crooked Path work. And this idea that there was three primary powers in the work of Dion Fortune, which was power, love, and wisdom. And it really just kind of synthesized a lot of the triplices in my life. And, you know, I just kind of popped out of meditation when I saw that image in my mind's eye and just started writing down all these correspondences and ideas and relating them to different types of spirit beings and what it really means to be a witch seeking enlightenment, a witch trying to seek, you know, a different way of looking at spirituality. And to me, it was through power, love, and wisdom. So the book kind of is based on that vision.
And you said that it's based on a lot of like the occultist writings and ideas. So what would you say is the difference then between occult versus witchcraft?
Well, I consider myself both. I think witchcraft is an occult science and occult art. I think occult is much more broad in general than witchcraft. I think anybody who's interested in a lot of the things we think of as the Western mysteries can be considered to be an occultist. But I know a lot of occultists, you know, they're seeking out that which is hidden, that which is unseen. And so I think, you know, we study things like Taoism. We study things like Tantric Buddhism. We study aspects of Hinduism because it's the things that are the science behind the metaphysics. I think occultists are really interested in understanding the nature of the universe and the nature of consciousness. Witchcraft has an aspect of that, but witchcraft is also spiritual and religious, you know, and artistic. So I think, you know, witchcraft expands in some areas that occultism does not, and occultism, you know, really looks to some things that witchcraft doesn't focus on as much. But as somebody who's both a practicing witch and an occultist, I see there's a lot of harmony and a lot of overlap between the two.
And you recently, very recently, wrote a blog or an article for witches and pagans called The Endangered Occultist.
I did.
And so, you know, I'm wondering if you feel that what you just described is something that is starting to be lost or that people are starting to move away from?
I do, actually. I get the chance to travel around the country and really the world now and go to different festivals and events and talk to people. I've noticed more and more, you know, some of the gigs that I do and the events are much more what people consider to be new age. And they seem to be afraid of that world occultist, but they're also not necessarily looking to explore the ideas of consciousness. You know, they're kind of happy with what they found and, you know, really don't get into the subtleties and aren't really looking to explore and how to apply the philosophies of it, which I think occultists, you know, don't just want to know, but they actually want to do as well. And I found in the pagan world, the part that I guess really motivated the article that I wrote was more about people who are bringing almost a religious fervor to a lot of our paganism and witchcraft and reconstruction of pagan traditions that, you know, I didn't see when I first got involved in this. It almost seems like the fervor that some people have in a very much more dogmatic religious sense in mainstream religions, you know, people are converting over or becoming interested in more pagan traditions, but kind of still bringing that fervor, where I think when people entered paganism with more of an occult perspective, they were more asking, well, why? You know, how does this work? What does this mean to me? And it really had much more of that kind of questioning authority and really trying to understand things firsthand through yourself and really looking to other cultures. It seems like we're getting another aspect of it, of people having difficulty, you know, looking at the worldwide traditions, where I think an occultist was looking for wisdom throughout the world. So really kind of get into this idea that if the Hindus can describe something better, then why don't we kind of look to their descriptions? And someone in the South American traditions describes something else better. An occultist wants to, you know, get precise language and try to understand things in a world context. And I think when I express that in some places, people often find that to be a difficult view to understand, particularly if they have that very strong religious current rather than kind of philosophical, occultist, experiential current. So that's, I just wanted to kind of stress that and just kind of point out how things have changed even in a short period of time. I've only really been doing this for 20 years, which some people think is a long time, but, you know, in retrospect compared to a lot of my peers is nothing. You know, if it's changed that much in 20 years, you know, where are we going with it? And, you know, where do we want to go with it? I think is important to ask.
And I wonder if that's an indication of an influence of modern culture, because everything is very quick and disposable now. I mean, you know, with Twitter, it's like you get an idea or you hear about something in 140 characters and then you're on to the next thing. In right. Facebook, you see it posted and then on to the next thing. Even when people write, and I've even been accused of this in things that I write, people say you have to write more in that blog style now, where it's short paragraphs and bullet points, because nobody will read a large block of text, which yeah. is what we used to call a paragraph. And, you know, and so, and I'm wondering if that, because for me, that what you were describing with the occultist, there's a sense of if you're going to explore the mysteries, you have to be willing to sit with them
right.
and allow for the time that it takes for them to start to kind of unfold and reveal themselves, rather than, you know, oh, I can read a quick little blog post about something and now I understand all about that aspect of things. Now on to the next thing. You know, and I wonder if that's starting to influence or affect pagans and how they're approaching their work, in the sense of making everything kind of quick and on to the next thing rather than sitting with something. You know, even when people do meditations and stuff, I've had people kind of push back and they're like, well, is this meditation going to be more than like 10 or 15 minutes? Because I can't really stay focused for more than that. And I'm like, okay, well, let's not sit in that space for too long then. We don't want to make you uncomfortable.
That's a great observation, and I agree highly. I think the new teachers in paganism have to, and, you know, really anything, not just paganism, have to have both those clubs in their you know, bag. They have to be able to say the short, pithy thing that engages people, and then they need to be able to, you know, expound upon things and to be able to have the time and create the time and space to teach deeper. You know, honestly, I still kind of struggle with the short, pithy part. You know, I'd much rather sit down and write a book than a blog. You know, and although the blog can reach somebody and, you know, have an immediate effect in that moment and get that immediate gratification because you get all the comments, I'm much more motivated to do those deep things. But I know to be able to continue to reach people, I have to also be able to do the kind of quick and pithy and inspirational. So I'm still kind of working on that. But I do think you're right. I think it's, you know, part of it's the mysteries. It's not an easy path. You need to sit with things. You need to let them unfold. It's like planting a seed. You don't just plant the seed and then boom, you got to plant. You got to kind of watch the process to it. But I think things are so quick in our society, we do have to figure out how to kind of satisfy that impulse and have both of those currents going on at the same time.
And I think when you talk about the teachers, I think that they also have to be careful not to fall into that trap of trying to accommodate or please everyone all of the time.
Absolutely.
You know, if people aren't comfortable with taking that time or, you know, spending, well, I know with some of, like with your Temple of Witchcraft courses, those are, each one of those segments is for a year and a day. And, you know, a lot of people would push back against that, and a lot of teachers would even start to take people who are saying, well, I would take your class if I could just do it in a month,
right.
You know, and then start to try to accommodate that rather than really sticking with it and then just catering to those people that are willing to do the work.
I think for me, you know, I reached a threshold before we established the temple and Copper Cauldron and all the different changes that have happened in the last 5 years of my life. You know, where it was kind of questioning, you know, where's my career going in terms of being an author, in terms of being a speaker, and really having to reframe it that, you know, I really don't want to be the author speaker. I want to be the teacher that, you know, happens to be involved in the community. I want to be the priest, and I happen to do these things that are writing and authorship and doing online classes and things like that to motivate and to create the type of community that I want, rather than think about myself as a speaker having to establish my name. You know, when I look at the career models that were out there, you know, I could turn one way, and I think I would have been forced to get more into that. You know, how do I accommodate this? How do I do the quick weekend workshop? How can I adjust things so I can do a class this weekend of 300 people rather than 30? You know, and that's not really what I want to do. So kind of going into the religious model of the nonprofit, starting up your own publishing company where you know, the pressure to sell 10,000 books isn't so high. You know, I can sell 1,000 books and be really successful at what I'm doing as much as I could with a large company trying to sell 10,000. But when you try to sell 10,000 copies of something, you have to make it as wide-reaching as you can because paganism is not that big to begin with. So when my publishers and I started having conversations about, you know, well, how can we adapt this to make people feel good about it? Or, you know, how can we make this a little bit more broad reaching to all the different types of paganism out there? I was like, that's not really my job, you know, and so how can I refocus this to be able to be successful and have the support and build the community that I think is important and not dilute the teachings? And that's been an important transition, a hard transition, you know, because I think my background before this was business. So having to go into the nonprofit model has been kind of alien. That's actually been really, really good, and it's, I think, helped focus me again on the work, so that's been important.
And I think something you just said there, if one of the questions that your publisher said right at the beginning was, how can we change this to make people feel better about it?
Yeah.
It's like, well, it's not always about making people feel better. Sometimes you need to provoke them or make them uncomfortable or make them work for it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, we got to one of my last books where, you know, we started talking about the last chapter, and I thought the last chapter was deep and on the mysteries and, you know, really important capstone to the whole teaching that was fairly commercial and available to the public and very welcoming and accessible. And the feedback I got was that, you know, it was a little too complex, it was a little too occult, it wasn't, you know, it wasn't as happy, you know, as people want to end on a happy note. And that was a very clear moment in my mind of like, oh, I don't do this anymore. You know, I mean, I need to really stay clear, and this is what I'm going to do. And I ended up getting my way and keeping the book the way I wanted it. But, you know, even just have to expend the energy and having to explain that to somebody is just not where I want to put my time and energy.
And you had mentioned a little while ago about some of that people coming into various traditions of paganism, but bringing some of that dogmatic or fundamentalist kind of approach or mindset into paganism, which paganism has always been thought of as so, you know, open and accepting and that kind of thing. And I think that there seems to be a really big push or a really big topic at this point around the interfaith movement and conversations. And one thing that seems to really be at the, I don't know if it's the forefront, but just a hot topic of conversation is the idea of, well, Christo-pagans. And then there's also atheist pagans, but people are starting to get into these like factions and these arguments around who is acceptable and who's not.
Right.
And, you know, do you think that there's, well, do you have any suggestions on how people can work to maybe reconcile some of those things and not get so caught up in the labels, the boxes, and even the non-acceptance of other people's approaches?
For me, it actually goes back to that occultist aspect, at least the word that I'm comfortable and familiar with. Having that philosophy of exploration and trying to understand, for me, has always made me more accepting, even when I did not agree or thought something was a bad idea. You know, for me personally, I could separate that out and say, well, that's your experiment in your life. What kind of a process are you getting through that? What kind of results are you getting from it? And, you know, sometimes the results people felt they were getting as opposed to how they lived their lives and how they modeled whatever they were experiencing might be two different things, but at least I could kind of observe both and hear what they had to say and make my own judgment for what it was doing for them. But it's I guess that's where the dogma part of it gets to it. For me, it's been a little less than some of those things, and I find myself often in the debate of the hard polytheism versus soft polytheism versus monist and hermeticist and all that, and people feeling very strongly about it. And for me, it was never really about a feeling or belief. It was about an experience. So one of the things I said in the recent article I put out on the occultist was, you know, kind of like the quantum physicist, you know, you deal with what shows up. So if the experience shows up like particles, which to me would be that very kind of hard polytheist, separate, distinct, individual experience, then that's how I deal with my experience, and you know, just as that's how I deal with people. And if, you know, the experience shows up very soft and very connected and very wave-like, and you know, where people would describe that as a little bit more of the soft polytheist or more of the hermetic concept of the divine mind and all gods are one god and all goddesses are one goddess, then that's the experience I go with. You know, but I'm really in the moment. What is the ritual? What is the right shaping things? and how do I go with that experience and how does that affect me, rather than having this very strong belief, well, you know, in this philosophical document or in this mythology, it's very clearly hard polytheist, so this is how it has to be, or it's very clearly soft polytheist, and this is how it has to be. I'm like, well, what's the experience based on these rituals? And so I can, you know, people would say I'm kind of hedging my bets or not making a commitment to it, but I think things are so bizarrely weird when we think of how, you know, quantum physics and, you know, all these other viewpoints and how the universe works, that things are not as solid and clear-cut as we'd like to think they are. So why would we think our religion and spirituality and magic would be as clear-cut and distinct? You know, some will look at, well, I don't do spells. I just make offerings to the gods and ask them to take care of it. You know, I think that can work, and I believe in making offerings to deities. But as a witch, I'm also in the science of spellcraft, and how can I implement my will, and how can I unite my will with something bigger? But it's not just kind of going to mommy or daddy and saying, please fix this all the time. It's how can I fix with?
And I think that this, what for some people seems almost a near obsession on labeling things, and what label do they fall into, and what label does everybody else fall into? It seems as if that's starting to get in the way of just doing the work.
Right. Well, I think the practice is the most important part. When I have conversations with somebody that I feel is heading in that direction, I'll be like, well, you know, what's your practice like? Or, you know, how did you come to that conclusion? What was the experience that brought you to that conclusion? And if someone can talk about their practice or their experience and feels comfortable with that and has clearly had that, I can be like, all right, well, you know, that was different from my experience, but I like hearing about it. But I'm surprised at the number of people who say, well, you know, this is what I was taught. And I was like, well, and once you were taught it, what'd you do with it? You know, or this is the way it is because I read it in a book, and there's really no experience behind it. That part is, I guess, the part that kind of frightens me.
Yeah.
You know, I expect to hear that in other traditions that are more dogmatic. I don't expect to hear that in paganism or witchcraft or magic.
Or the response of, well, who has time to practice? I have blog posts that I need to get up that are debating this topic.
Well, some people seem much more interested in the debate, you know, in online forums and, you know, things like that and podcasts and such than they are in the actual, you know, practice of it. I like the blogs and the podcasts that are coming from people who are practitioners because I feel like, you know, they're speaking from a place of experience again. Sometimes one becomes more important than the other, where I think it's really the practice that's the key.
And I think a book that you recently put out that could be part of that interfaith dialogue is Buddha, Christ, Merlin, Three Wise Men for Our Age.
Thank you.
And yeah. So, and I'm curious how you decided to focus on those particular three as the trinity.
It came from experience again, really. I was doing a workshop as a fundraiser for the temple a couple of years ago on Merlin. I was actually planning on writing a book on Merlin, and who knows, I still might. So whenever I have an idea or a pull to do something, I really want to teach about it first. So I did all this research on Merlin, kind of fusing my experiences with more of the history of Merlin and what some of my teachers talked about and shared about their experiences with Merlin. And at the end of the workshop, had this vision while I was guiding everybody into the last of the meditation. I like to leave a lot of space for people to have their own experiences and not have it be scripted just by what I'm saying to envision. And when we made contact with that intelligence, there was these three bright lights, kind of the colors of the three rays. So I saw them in red, blue, and yellow. And out of the figures were these three feminine presences that all kind of morphed into the three figures of the book's about. So there was a almost kind of like a Kuan Yin figure, I guess is how I'd describe it, almost morphing into a Dalai Lama type of figure, and then Dalai Lama becoming the Buddha, which was interesting. We were very much the Hindu type of Buddha with the top knot and the orange robes. And then an image of what looked like a Morgan Le Fay, which I expected with the workshop, kind of morphing into a Merlin wild man of the forest kind of figure. And then a much more kind of, you know, Catholic saint shrine image of Mother Mary as the star mother, the sky mother with the blue and the white and the moon under her foot and the sacred heart, and that kind of morphing and transforming into a very kind of Catholic saint image of the, you know, the very clean-cut, blue-eyed, you know, Jesus figure, not the historical, but the more iconic. And they all started kind of speaking to me about how each of their paths was leading to the same place, but each could have an emphasis on one of the three rays, and that even though they had an emphasis from my perspective on one of the three rays, each of their religions and the mystical side combined all three of these principles, all three of these rays. And it just kind of unfolded in my thoughts in the meditation there, and really had this impetus of, this is something you should share. So, you know, I really wanted to share it as a cross-connection view. You know, it's funny, it's my dad's favorite book right now, because he can relate it to what he learned as a Catholic, you know, and say, oh, Merlin is actually this holy figure. He's not just like a movie character or story character. And, you know, he didn't really know that much about Buddhism, even though he spent a lot of time in the East. So it was interesting to make that connection. And he shares that with friends and family members about how they're all having something similar together. They're all holy people. So it really unfolded in that way. So I'd like to say I had this great, you know, intellectual insight of how to be able to bring people together, but it was really the inspiration from meditation.
And have you experienced or explored any direct correlation to the three rays of witchcraft from those three?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. The way it was expressed to me, although they kept on emphasizing that all three had all three within them, but the initial kind of door opening was that Merlin is the magician, and looking at forms of magic as a process of changing the world through your will, related to the first ray, which is about will and power, the red ray. And it was that idea of impetus of making change. When Merlin gives a prophecy, is he really making a prediction, or is he stating outward, like, this is going to happen? So it really related to this idea of using magic, and it was a good way to use the kind of storybook image that people have of Merlin, which is really different from the folkloric image of Merlin. You know, the kind of wild man of the forest versus the blue robe and yellow stars and pointed hat kind of imagery. But people see magicians as this ability to make things change. So really focusing on the idea of will and change as the first ray through paganism and Merlin and kind of the indigenous magical traditions. With the Christian traditions, I think the biggest thing I've always gotten out of the Christian traditions as a former Catholic and someone who's had to really make peace with, you know, family that's Catholic and what were my experiences growing up and what were my strong beliefs compared to what they are now, is that to be Christ-like is to really be somebody who wants to love unconditionally. You know, the idea in the New Age traditions, they call it Christ consciousness or Christos consciousness. But it's reaching that place of unconditional love where you can be connected to others. And if you look at the core teachings of the Jesus figure, it's really about, you know, love God with all your heart, love your neighbors, yourself. It's really the sense of loving connection. Doesn't necessarily mean you lose boundaries, but you feel the connection and you have that compassion and that empathy. And even the iconography that we have of Jesus is the kind of statue figured in Catholic churches. It's either the martyr and the suffering, but I actually like better the image of the Sacred Heart, and, you know, and the artwork, the Sacred Heart radiating out this love and this compassion. So for me, the Christian traditions in Jesus was the second ray and the blue ray, which we describe as love and trust. So it's that kind of empathy and compassion that connects everybody. And then the third ray, it was a tougher one because a lot of times the key word we use for Buddhism is compassion. But in many ways, it's a very detached compassion, that you really get to that place of compassion by having a clarity of mind, a clarity of perception, realizing that so many of our sufferings come from our attachment, for our grasping, trying to get what we think we want in the world, or trying to avoid the suffering that we don't want, that they have a really great understanding of the mind and perception, and how the personal mind, you know, is really a construct, and how we're really connected to this kind of greater sense of universal mind, and the individuality that we really think we have might just be a bit of an illusion. So when we look at the Buddhist concepts of the mind and perception, I think that really relates to wisdom and the third ray, the way we describe it as the yellow ray, or the ray of wisdom and cunning, or wisdom and knowledge. So I think it really relates to those kind of wisdom and knowledge traditions. If you understand your mind clearly, then you come to a greater wisdom. It can lead to compassion as you turn it back out into the world, just as I think Christ can have a lot of wisdom in his teachings and understandings. I think Merlin can have a lot of wisdom and can have love as well. They all three have all three, but at the same time, you know, I think those are the entries of it. So I'd say Buddha is the wisdom, Christ is the love, and Merlin's the will.
And actually, in the Temple of Witchcraft, you and the two other founders, Steve and Adam, you at Ostara, you switch every year.
We do.
To each of you taking one of the rays. And so you just either just moved or are getting ready to move into, I think you're going to be the red ray of will and power.
You're good. We just moved. I am the red ray. Adam is the blue ray. And Steve is the yellow ray. So and that's kind of where we started out. So we've done a cycle of three now publicly. and we're starting out again. So it's strangely the configuration I think the three of us are the most comfortable with, because it suits a little bit of our natural personalities a bit more. But each year we try to take on a different role and really be mindful of those energies, both what we have to do ritually for them, but also in the way of leading the temple. You know, what is my role of it? So when I'm the red ray, I have to be a little bit more stronger and defensive, and the archetype we have of that is the sovereign or the king, you know, where the archetype of the blue ray deals much more with kind of the prophet, and the archetype of the third ray deals much more with the priest or priestess. So, you know, we try to hold those different things, and when we have conversations and have to make decisions, we try to offer our wisdom from that perspective.
And is that perhaps a technique or an approach that you might suggest to people, especially, well, if they're working through your book, The Three Ways of Witchcraft, or even if they're not, but maybe that's an approach they can take as, like, say, for a moon cycle, emphasize being one ray and see what that feels like, rather than just through one meditation.
Right.
But to really kind of experience it and embody it over the course of time, and then make a transition to another one over the course of time. Would that be an approach that you might suggest someone take?
Absolutely. I think once you've made contact with them all, there's a lot of preliminary exercises in the book that kind of build up to them. But once you make that connection, you're comfortable with those energies, at least in connecting with them, it's good to sit with, you know, whatever it is that you're working with, you know, whether it be the three rays and transitioning out of it. I also do a lot of stuff based on alchemy and the seven steps in the ladder to heaven, which is the seven planets. So, you know, a lot of my own personal work will be, you know, stay with a period of time with one of the planets, then move to the next one in the sequence and the next one. So I think you need that time to digest it. So I think that works really well with the three rays. And I think the three rays model works really well in leadership roles. I think one of the things I've found in a lot of ways in public community is that either the sole leader model or the dual leader, usually when it's with two partners, kind of the archetype of the high priest and high priestess in a lot of groups, it can go really, really well, or it can go really badly, and, you know, get corrupt very easily. Either the twos, when you're in a couple, the relationship and how well or how bad it's going can really influence the group, or sometimes there can be that kind of so strong leadership between the couple that there's no room for a lot of other differing opinions or other insight or other talents. So having a rotating roles of the three rays, we found, is a good kind of check and balance system. And as the temple expands, if we have other people kind of setting up little satellite temples in different places, one of the requirements will be is that the leadership of that little satellite has to at least have those three people to be able to rotate through those roles.
And I think that speaks to what we had mentioned before, because people may experience that surge of what it's like to be in that power or to put that will into action in a particular moment, in a particular meditation, in a particular situation. But that's very different than sitting in that place of power and putting will into action, say, over the course of a month.
Right, absolutely.
Now, The Three Rays of Witchcraft is not to be confused with another book you have called The Gates of Witchcraft.
It's all this witchcraft.
I know. So can you maybe just touch on what the gates are compared to the rays, and then what that focus is in The Gates of Witchcraft?
Sure. The gates are very different, and the book is very different. The gates actually are different methods of achieving trance. So it's a much more wider range book. It's not in a specific theology or teaching system. It can be used by witches and magicians and shamans of all different types, and not have a conflict with, you know, anybody else's experiences or traditions or theology. Really, it takes the Gardnerian Book of Shadows, has something in it called the Ways of Power, or the Eight Ways to the Center. And we kind of separate them out because there's some confusion in them. And then we add, or at least I've added, four more ways or four more paths to make it 12. And then we look at these 12 different techniques. Some of them are very inhibitory, or they really kind of lower your rhythm and your pulse and your, you know, kind of bodily systems to get into a trance. Others are very exhibitory, so they very much raise things. They excite you. They're the drumming and dancing type of techniques. And each chapter is like a lesson. In the beginning of the chapter starts with very simple techniques in that style. And by the end of the chapter, it ends in more advanced techniques. So some of the gates relate to herbalism and using herbs for trance, you know, from safer things like mugwort burning to, you know, talking about some of the poisons and some of the safe ways you can work with the poisonous plant spirits, but still work with them through homeopathy, through flower essences, through, you know, other techniques and traditions. We talk about pain, we talk about sexuality, but also the very basic types of things like, you know, simple focused attention for meditation, breath work, movement and body posture, dance, you know, things that a lot of us are familiar with, but it kind of takes things into a deeper direction. So we'll even talk about musical correspondences and using particular modes and keys to induce certain types of trance, or and we even go further into the idea of sacred place. You know, different places can induce trance, different times can induce trance, dreams and how to do dream work, that's a type of trance that we all work through, and even our clothing, you know, different types of things you can wear can automatically attune you to a way of being in magic, and taking those items off can take you out of that space, whether it be a ritual robe or a ring, or if you're not used to, you know, being naked, going skyclad, that puts a certain type of consciousness into action if that's a part of your training. So there's just a variety of different techniques to get into those trance states.
Is there any sort of previous experience or knowledge that somebody might need to have before, say, picking that book up to start working with those things? Or could a relatively new person to those kind of things be able to just jump right into that?
I think if you have a basic understanding of witchcraft or spellcraft or magic in general, you know, but a beginner could still pick it up. I think the thing is it's not a recipe book, so it's not so much a beginning to end how to be a witch or how to do magic. It assumes that you want to go deeper in your magic, so it has a little bit of ritual to it in the appendixes for people who want to have that type of script for them. But it's really experiential. So the very first chapter deals with, you know, just basic meditation. So if you're new to meditation, it gives you all the first steps.
So what's the difference between witchcraft and magic?
I think magic are techniques and skills in life and a way of looking at things that anybody can use despite or embracing their particular religious or spiritual paradigm. I think witchcraft is a specific paradigm that uses magic, but I think witchcraft, people who are witches, it's a very distinct strain. I think people who are witches, you know, have that earth-based aspect of it, but also the particular witchcraft I teach has a lot of stellar lore to it and a lot of sky and star work to it. But I think of witchcraft as more of a mystery tradition where magic, although it can lead to the mysteries, can also just be very functional. You can be a folk magician and Christian. You can be a folk magician and Buddhist, where witchcraft is a particular entry into the mysteries, I would say.
Now, would the techniques and things that the gates of witchcraft are about be really useful and beneficial if somebody was wanting to start working through your newest book, The Mighty Dead, in terms of connecting with and working with the ancestors and the spirit guides?
Yep, I think all my books I try to make a certain level to be self-contained. I'd say the exceptions are the Temple of Witchcraft series, which is a sequence of books. But even in those books, the preliminary chapters kind of give you a rundown of these are the minimum that you should know before starting this book if you haven't had the others. But there's always a complement, I think. I'm drawing all the stuff that I'm writing about from my own personal practice. It's not like I'm researching things that I really have no experience with and then I'm just sharing them. So there's always a cohesion with it. So whether it be the trance techniques of Gates of Witchcraft or whether it be some of the theology in Three Rays and the exercises that relate to the Love, Power, and Wisdom teachings, I think they really fit in with what I talk about in The Mighty Dead. But you don't have to have those things if you want to just pick up The Mighty Dead. It starts out with a lot of basic things that people don't talk about too much, but they're not out of reach for most people, like ancestral reverence and building an ancestor shrine and talking about the different types of ancestors and the dead and thoughts and the souls. And then it kind of builds up to more intense practices and kind of deeper mystical experiences. But if you follow the book in sequence, every chapter prepares you for the next.
So why work with the Mighty Dead?
Well, that's a great question. I don't think everybody has to, but I think a lot of us are called to. I would describe the Mighty Dead as akin to the ascended masters or saints or bodhisattvas, but in the witchcraft tradition. And I think the big reason why you'd work with them is if we're trying to move on to what the next level of experience is, whatever that may be. You know, I think it's so difficult to kind of define, you know, what enlightenment is, or, you know, what we feel like our next goal is, because, you know, until you get there, you're not really going to know. But I think there's a body of spirits that have reached that level of mastery in every tradition. And I think witches don't often reach out to the ones in our tradition. So I think part of it is being able to reach out and say, you know, I need teaching, I need guidance, I need help. For the longest time in the temple, we've had these teachings on finding your master teacher, basically finding your inner world teachers, not just your allies, not just your guide, is not your patron or matron deity, but the one that's really your instructor. And sometimes those things cross over, but sometimes they don't. And the Mighty Dead, and that really led me more and more to my understanding of the Mighty Dead, and to be able to share it as more of a collective teaching. But how do we find those who've gone on before us, those who've reached the next step? Because I think they're the best guides in helping us get there ourselves.
And this is different than, say, somebody who says, oh, you know, I see my grandmother standing next to my bed every night. My dead grandmother, let's say like that. If it's your living grandmother, you might be a little more worried. Why is she just standing over me every night? But when you refer to the dead here in this particular work, you're referring to something that's slightly different than what we might think of as psychic medium work or that kind of thing. Is that correct?
That's correct. I do talk about different types of dead in the book to try to explain those distinctions. But it's less the direct ancestors or loved ones, what some people call the beloved dead, and it's much more about the ascended ones or the enlightened ones, or what some people call the sanctified dead. And so the sanctified dead are the ones that are able to step off that cycle of rebirth and move to a different state of consciousness, a different state of being. So it's not so much that they're dead and resting and waiting to come back in reincarnation, or if you're in a different religious paradigm, you might say they've gone to heaven or wherever they may be. These are the ones that reached a mastery, that reached, you know, really the best word I can come up with it for it that people recognize is enlightenment. They reached enlightenment from a witch's perspective, and they're able to step off of that cycle of rebirth and really join others in this different level of consciousness. A lot of the mystical traditions have these teachings and have these ideas. I do a lot of comparisons in the book about different cultures and the names they had for it. But witches, you know, we've tended to ignore it, or some people feel this has been a very hidden, initiatory kind of teaching. Others believe, you know, it's been lost over the ages. So this is just really based on my research and my own experiences directly with them and what they've wanted me to share with you.
So if somebody was starting to do this kind of work, how do you identify who may be coming to you in terms of the difference between a spirit guide versus a loved one versus someone from the Mighty Dead? Is there some identifying characteristics or something that someone can have or use to be able to tell who's coming to them, and maybe then what way they need to be worked with?
Yes and no. I mean, I'm a big believer and like to joke with my friends and students that spirits are people too. Much the same way you discern what your relationship is with somebody you met in flesh and blood is kind of how you discern it with spirits. So, you know, some people approach you in a very friendly sort of comrade aspect to them, and they're equal, and they're very much wanting to offer maybe their opinion or advice or their companionship. And those are more of what I consider to be allies or kind of spiritual guides, but not necessarily these mighty dead and master teachers. There's others that you meet in your life who you just know this person's meant to show me something, is meant to teach me something. I'm going to study with them. I might join their coven. I might go take classes with them. And it might not even just be a metaphysical view, but, you know, in life you might decide whatever your vocation is, you meet somebody who's better at it, and they're going to mentor you in some way. But they also have that level of, I've been doing this longer, I have more experience, I'm at the next level, I'm your boss, I'm your manager, but I'm also here to help you. And that kind of quality comes across with those spirits that are the Mighty Dead. There's people that we think of as family, whether they're flesh and blood or not, and there's spirits we think of as spirit family, you know, whether they were flesh and blood in life or not, and they come across with much more of that family tone. I think, you know, even not just looking at the characteristics, which I think is important, but also asking, having conversations, finding a method through which you can communicate with the spirits. If you can't hear psychically, or see visions that give you information when you're meditating, then it might be, you know, working with the pendulum, working with automatic writing, working with muscle testing, working with, you know, some type of divination system where you feel that the spirit can talk through the runes or talk through the tarot cards and give you very clear answers. But it's figuring out what your method of communication is and then asking them, and also being willing to agree. Just because a spirit, whether it be mighty dead or otherwise, says, hey, I'm going to be your teacher. You know, if somebody came to you off the street, or if somebody at a pagan festival said, hey, I'm going to be your high priestess, and you're like, yeah, no, you're not. You know, I don't know you. Then you've got to build rapport. So don't just assume because the spirit said, hey, I'm going to do this, that you have to say yes to it. But usually if they're coming, there's a reason. So you might want to explore it.
Usually if a stranger comes up to me and just says they're going to be my high priest or high priestess, I know that that's only true if that means that we're going to have sex. Because I've heard in many traditions that's what happens, isn't it? That
sometimes, yeah.
It's traditional for the high priest and high priestess to have sex with everyone in the coven?
That depends on the tradition, but yes. and I don't necessarily think that sexual initiation is wrong, but I do believe it should be clear. And I was talking to somebody who said, oh, I almost joined this tradition, except, and she's much older now, was talking about when she was like 19 or 20 and she'd studied with this group and she left the night of her initiation. And I said, well, you know, why'd you leave, work so hard up until that point? Why would you leave in the night of initiation? She's like, that's when they sprung on me that I had to have sex with the high priest and nobody told me or prepped that for me. And I was engaged to somebody at the time. And, you know, I was like, that I have a problem with.
So, yeah.
You know, I think if someone comes in and says we're a sexual tradition and part of the teachings are to have sex with your teacher and this is why and this is what we think you get out of it and it's very upfront, I'm okay with it. But I think you got to be, like everything else, you got to be upfront and clear. Good communication.
I must have at least 150 high priests. So is there a way for somebody to be able to perhaps recognize that the time is right for them to start doing some of the work with the mighty dead?
Well, I think when you feel you hit what I refer to in some of the workshops and some of our writings affectionately, the Wiccan wall, and I don't mean that as any disrespect for the word Wicca, but you kind of get to the point where you get stuck with, you know, reading all these Wheel of the Year books and you know, spellcraft books and moon ritual books and, you know, really wanting to go deeper with something. Either you'll be led to the right books that will help you go deeper. And I think I've tried to write in that frame of what were the things I wanted that weren't available for me. But also that idea of feeling not so much that you outgrow physical world teachers, because I think there's always good people to study with, but you feel like, you know, you need that deeper kind of day-to-day mentorship from an inner plane teacher, an inner plane adept, when you feel like you've plateaued and, you know, you're kind of stuck in your practice and looking to go deeper. I have found that when I've made contact with these types of teachers, they've always challenged me to go deeper in ways that I didn't always expect. So, you know, suddenly I found myself having to study things that they were guiding me to and directing me to that, you know, was not what I would have chosen for myself, but it did serve. So I think getting that kind of inner world guidance can be really powerful when you plateau out and you feel like you haven't gone deeper, because they kind of give you that nudge to climb higher on the mountain or kind of go deeper into the cave, but to find, you know, a better source of wisdom. So I think when you feel like you've just been kind of skating by, that's a good time to go for it.
So if somebody was at that point, and aside from, of course, purchasing your book, The Mighty Dead, what might be one suggestion you would give to start the process of connecting with and working with the mighty dead for somebody if they felt they were ready for that?
I would suggest, you know, really staying a very clear intention. Do what we might consider to be a petition spell. Write out your intention to connect with the mighty dead. Do it sort of in a what I might describe as a prayerful manner, asking the universe, God, goddess, however you see it, to kind of open the way and connect me to a master teacher from the mighty dead that is for my highest good. I might do it in the full moon or the new moon and burn it, you know, in a ritual space, but really sincerely set that intention and then make myself available. You know, I would start meditating and being open to it. A lot of the book has the vision work to connect to it, but even without that vision work, you know, getting into a quiet space, being open and receptive and having set that intention to commune with this inner world teacher, or teachers, because sometimes they show up in a group, but really kind of setting that space for it and listening, because a lot of times we set the intention, oh, I want a teacher, and then we never slow down to actually listen if a teacher did show up.
Well, I think that goes back to what we were talking about before, which is if you say and you even do a petition to start doing that, you have to be willing to start setting aside and making the time for that space and that ability for them to start coming through, rather than, well, I would, but I'm too busy because I have 17 other things that I need to be doing, and I don't know where, when or where I would do it. And then I was going to do it, but I was so tired. And, you know, it's like, well, you have to be willing to start making time for it.
And it's the same thing with any magic, whether it be something deeply spiritual, whether it be something that we think of as kind of outer world mundane. You know, I do the spell for a new job, and I won't let go of this job that I have that I may hate because, you know, I don't know, well, what would happen, and what if this new opportunity that I'm being offered isn't the right opportunity? And, well, I thought the gods would, you know, make it clear to me. Well, they did. You know, they gave you a job opportunity. You asked for it, you know, take it. God comes, spirits come, magic comes in mysterious ways that are very mundane, and we've got to be willing to say yes. We've got to be able to open the door. We've got to be willing to make space.
And I think that that goes back to something you had touched on earlier, which is a lot of people just make offerings to the gods, and usually they do that when they're going to ask for something.
Right.
But people don't want to see that there's actually a part of them having to be responsible and take action and do the work as part of the magical process, rather than they just get to go ask for it and it's like dropped in their lap in some way.
Yeah, I mean, very clear in your intention. I know a lot of people do offerings and ask for help, will ask for help, but won't even ask for specifically what they want in that help. They're just like, oh, the gods will give me what they think I want or what they think I need. But sometimes they'll only give you what you're clear about. And if you're not clear, I don't think it always works that way. So it's about uniting your will with something higher. You know, I find I give my offerings more often than not when I don't really need anything. You know, I think the offerings help build a strength of connection and really develop a relationship. You know, who wants to see that friend that always only comes by and is like, hey, I got this little gift basket for you. Now can you do this for me? You know, we all avoid that person, you know, so what makes you think the gods will be any different? But if we're very heartfelt and sincere and making our offerings and connections and spending time with the gods to build a relationship, I think they're more apt to be there. Part of that setting into motion, I think, is taking ritual action. Like, notice for the Mighty Dead, I said not just, you know, set the intention, but write it down, be in ritual space, burn the paper, scatter the ashes, you know, do something that puts your body into it, that makes it physical. Because I think a lot of times people just hold the thought over and over again, and sometimes the thought becomes more and more vague. Like, I just want that job. I just want that job. Oh, any job will do. And then you say, hey, waiters are hiring, and people don't want to hear that.
Right. Or if you're only holding that intention every time you're angry at the place where you currently work, and it's a reactionary intention.
Right. Yeah, and that doesn't really work too well. I think you've got to be really free-flowing with it. Magic can work in anger, but I found magic for a beneficial change for your life doesn't work often well in anger.
Well, right. And because I wouldn't really say from a magical standpoint, I wouldn't say that that doesn't really work. I would say that that generally will work, but it's going to work in a way that you probably didn't want.
Want. Yes, absolutely.
When you talked about the Wiccan wall, and then we were talking about initiations and that kind of thing, do you have any thoughts on... Not what the differences are necessarily, but what the benefits and sometimes the challenges are of, say, a solitary practitioner versus a practitioner who is a part of a coven or a group of some sort versus the teacher-guru kind of relationship?
Oh, well, I think they all have potential for really great benefits, and they all have potential for really great drawbacks. So I guess it depends on which set you feel would be... most beneficial for you at that time. You know, I think, you know, as an occultist, a lot of occultists over the ages have been these solitary practitioners and explorers. And I think that can be great because you kind of create this own paradigm and you have to be really self-motivated. So it's kind of a self-regulating mechanism. If you can't bother to do it, then, you know, it's not going to happen. So it prevents too many people from going too far too fast. But at the same time, I feel like, you know, you have to build up, even as a solitary practitioner, what I'd consider to be a peer group or a community group, because I think unless you have other practitioners to tell you you're going off the rails, because sometimes it's very easy to go into self-delusion. Sometimes it's very easy to believe your own hype, either in the outer world or the inner world. And I think having good, trusted mentors, peers, teachers who can kind of speak truth to power is a really important thing. And I think a lot of solitaries lose out on that. I think a lot of people who can kind of wreak the greatest havoc in our greater community are the lone practitioners who come in with great pronouncements of they're this or they're that when they've not really been engaged in the community and they haven't had those checks and balances. And I think also you can get stuck really easily. Like you can hit that wall a lot easier and not find the right inspiration or find the right book or the right guidance to open the door. So I think that's the drawback. But I think when you're on your own in the solitary world, there's a great peace and there's a great freedom and there has to be a lot of motivation. And if you can make the inner world spiritual contact, I think it can be very rewarding. Group situations like covens. I've been a part of a coven, even though I kind of keep an individual practice as well, but I was part of a coven for a good 17, 18 years in various forms. And it was only really when the temple became very public and formal and legalized that most of the people in the coven got absorbed into the leadership of the temple, and we don't really practice in the same way. And, you know, the great teaching of coven work is what we like to call the grist for the mill, you know, all the interpersonal frictions and all the dislikes and the likes and all the kind of politics that go on. It can either be horrific, you know, because people take it very, very seriously and personally, or it can be a great teaching tool when you start to realize that, you know, it's all part of the work and it's all part of fashioning the personality. If you think of the teachings of Gurdjieff, he talked about the friction of community, spiritual community was necessary, and that he talked about the friction of people. And that was all about kind of polishing the diamond and really kind of getting us prepared. And I think there's great truth in that. But you have to have teachers and leaders in the coven that can set that tone and hold that space. And unfortunately, sometimes we get teachers and leaders and high priestesses and high priests who can't hold that space and get just as much as in their stuff with their students, which I think can get difficult and murky and unclear and cause a lot of problems and a lot of hurt feelings because the boundaries haven't been established clearly. And then the guru-disciple one is probably the one I have the least amount of experience with. I've studied a lot of Eastern lore, and I almost got involved in a Sikh tradition, believe it or not, because I was very interested in the type of yoga that they were proponents of. But when it became far too religious and really seemed to be promoting the guru-disciple relationship without that making it clear when I walked through the door that that's what we're going to, I had a big reaction against that because that's not what I was looking for. I was really looking for the yoga part of it. But over the years, I've seen some people really go really wonderfully through the guru-disciple relationship. But I've also seen and heard stories first and second hand from people who've really kind of been in abusive situations where the power between guru and disciple has been, you know, not always exercised in the best way. So I think like anything else, it's got those blessings and drawbacks. I just can't really speak from direct experience on that one. Although we have a lovely person in the temple, we've got actually a couple of them that have had previously or still maintain guru-disciple relationships while they're also witches. And they've had lovely experiences with it and found it very illuminating and enlightening. And for some, they even see that as their core practice and witchcraft is secondary. And they've been able to make it work in a way that, you know, maybe I wouldn't be able to, but I have great respect for, you know, the path that they're walking and that line that they're walking, and they seem to have great benefit of it because they're evolving personally and their magic's evolving. So I think the proof's in the pudding, and if it's working out for them, then I'm all for it.
And I've also found that it can be really beneficial, especially for somebody who's been solitary. I tend to think of it from the Buddhism standpoint because you have the three aspects of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha.
Yep.
If somebody has been reading and meditating and all of those things on an individual basis, they can hit a point where they can't really learn to the next level without starting to interact with one or more others, whether it's with a teacher or with a group. Mm-hmm. But what I've often found is really nice and revelatory is when you start being and it's not like you have to always be with a group, but when you start working with a group as well, you either hear questions asked that you wouldn't have thought to ask but are now very illuminating for you and take you to another level or put you on a different direction of learning or open up something for you hadn't thought of. Mm-hmm. Or somebody asks you something, and when you look after you've answered and realize how much you've just said to them, you go, wow, I didn't ever realize that I knew that much.
Right.
And you realize that I don't need to keep reading the beginner books, even though I kept seeing myself as a beginner, because I hear myself actually being able to give information that shows I'm beyond that point that I was not able to see when I was just isolated in my own little space.
Yeah, absolutely. I think people in those situations, whether they be peers or community and teachers, provide that mirror too. You know, sometimes we can think we have a certain mastery on it until we're confronted by it and realize that we don't have it, or sometimes we're really pleasantly surprised to be like, wow, I really did know that, and I really did handle myself well in that situation, and, you know, maybe I'm doing much better than I thought I was. So absolutely. And I do like the Buddhist comparison. I've actually been doing a lot more reading on Tantric Buddhism and kind of these comparisons and trying to understand, you know, how some of this can shape as an occultist, my practice and witchcraft, and you know, what's beneficial in these ideas. And I do think the community part of it, you know, is a part that's not understood, even though it's practiced in paganism. I think people don't look at the sacred nature of community in quite the same way. And I'd like to see that change, really.
And especially if you can approach coven work differently than just being social.
Right, right. And even approaching every social aspect as potentially sacred.
Right.
You know, I was having a talk, I was teaching down in Salem, Mass, and, you know, it was this idea of thinking every battle that you have in public or private, every disagreement you have, every supposed witch war that's going on, if you can hold yourself like this is a sacred act where we're working stuff out, and these hurt feelings are sacred offerings to work stuff out, you can carry yourself through those difficult times in a much different way than if it's all personal.
So, you know, we talk a lot about the gods, and yes, I include gods and goddesses in that.
Yep.
for anyone listening out there that has those issues, I'm curious if you think whether the gods evolve and change over time, perhaps in direct relationship to the kind of worship, recognition, work that is done by beings on different levels? Or do you think that, for example, we're working with the same gods and goddesses in the same way as they were for our ancestors hundreds or thousands of years ago?
That's a great question. That was actually a debate in our Witchcraft 2 class right now. I took a quote, which I'm going to paraphrase awfully because I don't have it in front of me right now, but it was from Austin Spare. And basically, in the quote, it says, I've never outgrown my gods because my gods continue to grow with me. So the kind of the debate question was, is, you know, we usually think of particularly pre-paganism, coming into paganism or Wicca or witchcraft, that the concept of God is absolute. And that's sort of what, you know, makes God, God, absolute. So now we have this polytheistic view of gods. Do we see gods as absolute forces that don't change, or do they change and evolve? Are they beings? Like in the Buddhist traditions, you know, the gods have their own karma and they're working out their own stuff, and you know, they haven't reached that level of enlightenment either. They're you know, one of the six types of beings that are existing. So do we have that perspective? And you know, I think those are really great questions, because we've not come to a clear theology that most people accept in modern paganism today. I certainly can say I think our perception of the gods evolve. I think our relationships with the god evolve, how they express themselves evolve. I also think that there's a life cycle to different gods. I think certain gods over the ages have died. So the very fact that, you know, no one's worshipped them, no one remembers them, there's no imagery that goes on with them. I had some friends who were working with a teacher who talked about how you could go to the edge of the abyss and pull out forgotten knowledge and pull back forgotten gods. And I thought it was an interesting concept. I'm just like, should we really be doing that? Like, is there a reason why they might be in the abyss and maybe that consciousness no longer serves? But at the same time, you know, I think of different gods being syncretized together, and, you know, different goddesses and gods, as they got popular, absorbing the traits and attributes and even names of other gods. So did like one god or goddess eat another god? And now you can very visibly see them in that deity, but, you know, do they still exist as an individual entity? I don't know. You know, I think that's the great thing about occultism, is we like to ask a lot of questions and do rituals and experiments to see what we experience, but there's not a really great answer to say, you know, this is it, and this is the right answer for everybody, and this is definitive. You know, I've had experiences with Anubis, you know, it's probably my funniest favorite one, where Anubis would appear to me in a biker leather jacket, you know, and had this very kind of modern regalia, except he was this, you know, jackal-headed, you know, deity coming towards me. But he was not in the traditional Egyptian arraignments. And, you know, I said that to somebody who was a comedic practitioner, and they were like, oh, you know, it was almost they wanted to say sacrilege. But at the same time, you know, that was my experience of it, and that's how he related and conveyed things. And, you know, the image is a very popular goddess right now people have is Hecate. And, you know, it's really interesting to watch the internet fights of, you know, this is what Hecate is versus this is what, you know, someone's experience is. And I'm much more interested these days, although I think the reading of the old lore and understanding of it is really important, but I'm really interested in seeing how she shows up for other people. And, you know, is that the same face of the same entity? Is that a different entity that's grown out of the original Hecate? And, you know, one saying of it was coming from someone very close to me was that they saw Hecate in more of this crone phase, which is the great debate. You know, is she a crone? Is she a maiden? But when you keep on saying she's one of the oldest goddesses in the world, then you start thinking of her as old. So, you know, whether she always manifested as a maiden or not, I think that's why we get that imagery in our relationship with us, because we think of her as older than the Titans. So we think of her older than the Olympians. But she, you know, appeared as this little old woman, kind of granny figure, carrying a dog in her purse. You know, I thought that was such a great modern image and a great way of trying to get something across, although I think the traditionalist would look horrified by that. But if that's how she's expressing herself to somebody who's devoting energy to her and building a relationship with her, who's to say that that's wrong if they're getting a result from it?
And why wouldn't they appear in a way that is either culturally recognizable, time period recognizable, or even is just in some ways comfortable for the person that is seeing them at that moment, rather than appearing in some way that just feels foreign or might be scary or be like, I don't even know what to do with that.
Right. And I think they always have, too. Like, I recently remember seeing a statue. I've been on an Egyptian kick lately, and it was a statue of Horus dressed as a Roman soldier. You know, so that's not the classical imagery of Horus, but it was an old statue of Horus, you know, but dressed as a Roman soldier. So it was from a later period where there was the Roman influence, and so that's the way those, you know, with that Roman influence could connect to Horus. So why not? I mean, it's I think the gods have been changing this whole time, but I think it goes back to speaking about that orthodoxy that we talked about, that, you know, certain people feeling that, you know, this is the way it has to be because this is the way it's always been, but that's not really true. Things have always been changing.
And being myself Kemetic, you know, one of the main things in Egyptian thought is they don't look at things as either or, but they look at things in the terms of and. And so there's no reason why, for example, Hecate couldn't be a crone and a maiden.
Right.
Or why Anubis couldn't appear in Egyptian garb and leather bar gear.
Exactly.
If that's happened, is that where you were having your vision?
It was more motorcycle, you know, Hell's Angel kind of thing, but I can see where you go with that.
But I think that if people, and it even goes to the interfaith stuff we were talking about and all of that, if people would be able to see that allowing for both and doesn't exclude either from being right and doesn't dismiss someone's experience.
Yeah. I feel as an occultist, I'm always trying to find models that support people's fervent experiences, particularly if they've told me about them firsthand. And you can really feel a visceral energy when someone's had an experience that's touched them deeply. And at the same time, you know, accounts for good, sound, magical theory and theological underpinnings to it. So, you know, a lot of the models I'm looking for, one of the reasons I'm focusing so much on the threes, whether it be the three rays or the three souls or the three worlds, is that I think it creates a lot of options for those ands that you're talking about. And that, you know, you can have one of the things that we talk about in the Mighty Dead book is this idea of reincarnation. And we have this ancestral reverence. Yet a lot of us believe in reincarnation. A lot of people who are involved in reincarnation have strong feelings that reincarnation is genetic memory. Yet a lot of us have past life incarnations that have nothing to do with anything that we feel is a part of our genetic ancestry. So which is ready? Which is right?
Well, and I think it was in, maybe it's in the Inner Temple book. I forget which, if it's the Inner Temple or the Outer Temple book, where you talk about the different theories of reincarnation.
Yeah.
And there's one in there that I had never heard, but as soon as I read it, I said, ah, at least for me, that's it. And
yeah.
It's the, because it also ties into my Kemetic aspect, because, you know, for us, you go back and everything came out of Nun, which was like the primordial waters. And so one of the theories that you had talked about was that we come out of that and then we go back into those primordial waters. And I think of it like a glass, You know, every time that we're incarnated, it's like dipping a glass into the primordial waters, and that's the form we take for that lifetime.
Right.
Then when we die, it gets poured back in. The next lifetime, another glass is scooped up. Well, there could be a few drops of that water from a previous time in that new glass of water. Hence the reason why you can have, say, 1,000 people all saying that they were Cleopatra.
Right. Exactly.
Because they all have a few drops of Cleopatra from when they were Cleopatra.
Yeah.
And that is that. That's the theory to me that made the most sense. Plus, it also allows for the and, because it doesn't say you have to just be this or this or this to reincarnate or something, or where you came from, versus, no, you can be this and this, because
right.
there's elements or aspects or drops of that in there.
And I kind of took that model in The Mighty Dead and talked about the three souls and kind of took it a stage after that and said, you know, when you die, what happens to those three souls and how do they go back and what are their images of that primordialness, you know, and that can account for the lower soul dealing with genetic memory and the higher soul dealing with global memory and the middle soul dealing with ghosts and ancestral reverence and graveyards and, you know, and then even when those things break down, how do they go back to those primordial waters? But I'm always looking for, you know, that and. I think things that are deep and true will resonate when they share it with other people and will grow. And the things that are just for that individual or might even be delusional will stay with that individual and not necessarily grow. So I'm not too, I think the gods are pretty self-regulating. And I
think it's what you were saying. If you heard somebody saying that, it would be that visceral reaction that you're feeling as well when they're saying that because of the energy that's coming from them relating that.
Right, right. And you can feel a gut sense of, oh, viscerally, this is really good. Or I might have a visceral personal reaction to say, wow, that okay, that didn't make any sense to me, but tell me what it means to you, and let's go from there. You know, also, I think part of that reaction is, you know, knowing the nature of a god. Once you've connected to a god, you can connect to like a thread and a chain of associations. And if something is wildly, wildly out of left field, you know, then you might say, this is a little suspect. If, you know, something isn't so deeply out of left field, you can say, oh, I've never seen that. I never would have thought of that. But maybe I can sort of see what you're saying. That gives a greater sense for that and that allowance, you know?
Which goes back to having to spend the time to even just know what it feels like when you're in the presence of divinity
mm-hmm.
or deity. Right? Because even that, in a general sense, is going to give you a clue of, yes, this is what I'm dealing with versus, oh, it's a canary, you know, but you would at least have that sense of what you experience when you're in the presence of deity.
Right. Right. And I'm a big believer in whenever you can start with the traditional, because I think that does give you a foundation.
Mm-hmm.
But if your experience varies from the traditional, also go with who shows up and go with what your experience is. But part of that community and part of that tradition gives you a little bit of a check and balance. You know, if what you're experiencing is radically different than anything that's come before, and possibly what you're experiencing is not helpful or healing for you, it's always good to have a teacher or tradition to say, maybe you need to stop this and reevaluate. But if it's something that's helpful and healing for you and it has some type of connection or thread to the mythos, you know, I think a good teacher will say, hey, explore that and see where it takes you.
So when you have those questions of doubt or uncertainty or are feeling burnout or maybe just are feeling disconnected from the work and feel like it's just become rote or that kind of thing, what keeps you going in doing this work?
I think having a really good peer support group has been huge, huge, huge for me. To know that there's a group of people who experience both a deep level of the mysticism and the magic, but also, honestly, a lot of my peer group are other authors and teachers and leaders of organizations. And to know that they have my support and that they support me, and, you know, to be able to reach out to them freely when I feel like I need that help has been huge, huge, huge. You know, I can't emphasize that enough, to be able to have people to run ideas across, to be able to express frustrations. Because sometimes the frustrations of one person where you're at, when you try to express it to somebody who's never been in that position, you know, won't understand what you're talking about or won't appreciate, you know, what you're dealing with. But when you talk to another tradition leader or another author or another public speaker, you know, another person who does this, you know, to a great level in terms of living. A lot of people just don't have the time to be devoted to the mysticism as much as a lot of the people who, you know, are working this through their part of their day job as well. You know, I don't have to go to an office 40 hours a week at this point in my life. So, you know, it's made it a little bit easier for me to be able to do meditative work and ritual work regularly. And a lot of it is expected of by my community. So I'm a big part involved in that too. So to be able to talk to people who have those same expectations from their community and are able to bounce ideas and to be able to share and have fun has been huge.
For people working on a personal level, if they're feeling burned out or feeling as if, you know, well, I do my little altar ritual every morning, but I just kind of do it. I don't feel like there's anything really happening. What would you recommend for pushing past those periods?
I think it's honestly the same answer, just the appropriate peer group. Before I started doing this, I had a really amazing group online that was a kind of support chat group of various witches and mystical seekers and healers. And I got a lot of insight and I got a lot of inspiration and I got a lot of that community, even though it wasn't a physical community. And I think even reaching out to the local community, if you don't have a coven, can be really great, whether it be pagan meetups or trying to reach out at different events that might not always be your cup of tea, but will give you a chance to meet other people and see how other people do things. I've sometimes been just as inspired by looking at people and saying, oh, I've never really thought of that, and maybe I would never do it that way, but that reminds me of this and this, and maybe that will be added to my practice now, or, you know, going to a different class or something like that. There's little bits of inspiration you can draw from different places, but I think you have to reach out. You know, I think sometimes when you're solitary and you're just doing things by yourself, it's very easy to get stagnant, you know, if you don't have something internal that's pushing you. So sometimes the external can be giving you an inspiration and give you a boost. I love going still to festivals and to conventions where I get to go to other people's classes and other people's rituals after mine are done, because I learn so much and I see so much and I get to talk to so many really inspiring people. I can bring that back to my own personal practice. I can bring that back to my community. That really revitalizes me. And I think talking to other people that get stuck, I think when they reach out, they seem to get that revitalization too. I always try to challenge myself by going to things that might not always be the topic that I have an interest in, because often at this point, things that I have a lot of interest in, I've already done a lot of research on. So I always like to be introduced to different topics and different ways of looking at things and going to rituals from different traditions. You know, until I started going to conventions, I knew a lot about on paper about things like Andre Akfein, ADF, but I never really had seen the rituals in the flesh and blood. So being able to go to conventions and see how they did things and the order of service and, you know, how they took things was very inspiring. And there's some things and there was like, oh, I can do that, or I can add part of that to it, or this might be a little bit better than what I'm doing right now, or to be able to go to fairy tradition stuff and to be able to go to reclaiming stuff. You know, on the East Coast, it's not as public. So when I've been able to do events on the West Coast and be able to go to those events, it's been really interesting to watch. It's a very different culture, and it's very inspiring in a lot of ways because it is so different. And to be able to kind of bring some of those ideas back have been amazing. So yeah, I think it's good to push yourself into different areas that, you know, might not be things you're already comfortable with, because that's where you get the dynamic tension to be inspired.
And sometimes you're inspired because you go to something that's completely different, and then you go, that's just very similar to what I do or what my tradition does.
You know, going to some voodoo rituals down in New Orleans, it was really interesting to see how the technique of it was so different, but a lot of the theory of why you were doing things and how you were doing things and the type of contact was so similar. You know, everything from the pole in the center to be like the world tree, to calling in the spirits with different, you know, sigils, but not calling them sigils. You know, having songs to call and invite rather than invocations, but, you know, it was really inspiring and interesting to see it in a totally different cultural context. But a lot of the basic kind of components were part of the human religious experience. You know, as talking about occultism so much in this interview, that, you know, I always go back to Isaac Bonowitz's Real Magic book. And I remember very clearly a passage and reading it years and years ago, but him comparing, you know, the Catholic Mass to a Wiccan circle, to, you know, other types of religious ceremonies, and talking about there's some basic shared components that are part of like humans doing rituals.
We've mentioned many times throughout this the temple of witchcraft, Do you want to just give a quick overview, because you finally have bought a physical property for the temple to now be located in New Hampshire, and there are various things moving forward with the building of that. Do you want to give a little bit of update on what that is and how that's going?
Absolutely. For people who don't know, the Temple of Witchcraft bought last October a 5-acre land with house, with barn and cottage to serve as the headquarters for the Temple of Witchcraft. We feel very strongly that as a land-based, earth-based tradition, we should actually have, you know, land and earth and places to do things outside and inside. So as many pagan groups end up renting from stores and Masonic halls, and that's what we've been doing for the last few years, we established an office as a rental space and made sure we could, you know, be able to pay a mortgage, and we're able to get a mortgage and land and to get this space. It's a wonderful, beautiful Victorian house and has a wonderful barn to the inside of it and 5 acres out into the woods where we anticipate that there'll be shrines and ritual space. And if I have my way, a stone circle in the back would be awesome. And the difficulty, though, is right now the town of Salem, we've gotten approved for it, but we're in Salem, New Hampshire, not Salem, Massachusetts. But in Salem, New Hampshire, the town requires us, like any other church, to have appropriate facilities for parking. So we have to have a paved parking space with appropriate lights. So we're currently doing a fundraiser for that. And the sooner we can get the parking lot set, the better, because at the moment right now we're paying both for the land that we've bought and for the office that we rent. So what we'd like to be able to do is switch everything from the office to our new space as quickly as possible. And so for that, we need to raise money for that. We've got a Indiegogo campaign going on right now. It's a crowdsourcing event, much like Kickstarter, but it's really good for nonprofits. And so I believe it's indiegogo.com/TOW parking, but you can also find out all the information and a link through templeofwitchcraft.org. We're a bit over our halfway mark at this point, so we've got about a month left for the fundraiser before the Indiegogo campaign has to stop, and we're really hoping to have that all set. So if anybody feels that this is a worthwhile cause, please feel free to click over there on your website, and you can make a donation. It'd be greatly, greatly appreciated.
Do you want to mention some of the classes, online courses, appearances that you have coming up?
Sure, sure. I'm going to be, I guess the next biggest conference I will be is in May. I'm going to be down in Colorado for Beltania, which is obviously a Beltane celebration. So I'm going to be teaching down there. I think Wendy Rule is one of the other guests down there, so I'm actually excited to be down there. It'll actually be my 40th birthday, so Wendy says she's going to, you know, party with me and have a good night. So,
wow.
And after that, I think will be the Temples Festival called Temple Fest that happens June 15th and 16th in New Hampshire. So we have a lot of people involved in the temple, and a lot of people just from the local community come out for that and have a chance to have classes and sharing. The guest speaker for that event will be Ellen Dugan, so we're very excited to have her come out, and she's going to be teaching about her new witch's tarot. For the summer, I'm relatively quiet. We're going to be going on a retreat to Wales with the Temple of Witchcraft, and that'll be in August, so planning all that has taken up a lot of my time.
And that's a part of a 4-trip series?
Yeah, that's the plan. We'll see. This will be number 2, so we'll see how it goes. But we ended up planning just one to Glastonbury last year, or 2 years ago, really, and had a very strong vision, a few of us, in the gardens in the Chalice Well, about how we needed to deepen the roots of the Temple of Witchcraft by doing rituals in the lands of the 4 Celtic countries, the 4 main Celtic countries. So we've planned to do, that was England, we're going to do Wales, Scotland and Ireland, and we're taking a year off in between each trip to give people time to save and give us time to plan.
And if somebody was interested in those trips, where would be the best place for them to find information?
Info is on both my website, ChristopherPenzack.com, and on TempleOfWitchcraft.org. At the moment, the Wales trip is all booked up. But we're taking a waiting list, and if the last event was any indication, sometimes things get topsy-turvy right before you go, and you know, people who were going suddenly can't because of family emergencies, and people on the waiting list suddenly have the opportunity to go. So if you're interested, there's contact information. I believe it's WalesMagic with a K at gmail.com is the place to email to be on the waiting list.
And also information about your books and other appearances and things are all on your website at ChristopherPenzack.com as well.
That's right.
And to finish, I ask each of my guests a question that the previous guest has posed for them without knowing who it was going to be.
Okay.
And then I'm also going to ask you to ask a question to whoever my guest might be next month.
Okay.
So I'll give you the question that the previous guest asked, and then you can ponder it if you would like.
Okay.
And you can answer in either order that you want to. So my previous guest was Dr. Paul Harrison. This was last month in March, and he's an Egyptologist in London. And his question wasn't overly serious. He decided he wanted to have a little fun, you know, those Egyptologists. So his question was, if you could only eat one type of cuisine for the rest of your life, what would it be and why?
Well, you know, what would be my favorite would probably not be, you know, best order for my health.
Then you wouldn't have to eat it for too long to get bored.
I know. I'm addicted to crackers. That's my little...
I love white men, too. And I eat them. Oh, no, wait.
I was going to say, you know, salty ones are very few go fast. So, you know, but yes, I'm addicted to crackers. You know, I've got more of a salt thing going on. So I think it'd be some type of cracker would be my only food, although it would be horrible for you.
Well, his answer was Indian. He went very broad.
He
gave himself much more latitude for variety there.
See, I didn't know you could do ethnic, you know, ethnic range. I guess I'm actually, you know, a big fan of Indian as well, but I'm going to stick with my answer, crackers.
Crackers. Crackers for the rest of your life.
Exactly.
All right.
So I need to give you a question now?
It is true.
Okay. Mine will be kind of fun sort of as well. What is your favorite poison?
Ooh.
You like that?
I do.
I would say my favorite poison is Datura.
Yes. Yeah. Thank you very much for having spent time in this conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a lot of fun.
And stay tuned, because coming up in our Magical Moment segment, Christopher is going to stick around and give us a meditation. Do you want to give us a little sneak peek on what that's going to be about?
Well, for those of us in the Northeast, we've been buried under tons of snow. So I'm thinking of a post-Astara, pre-Beltane, kind of springtime, rising with the goddess type of meditation.
All right. And for those who are listening who may not know what Astara is,
the spring equinox, it's one of the names that we use for the spring equinox. It has a lot of cultural similarity to the holiday that people associate with Easter. A lot of the things that you might not understand why it connects with Easter were originally pagan traditions that got absorbed into the Christian holiday, things like the colored eggs with symbols on it and the idea of bunnies for fertility and such, and seeds and the flowers and all that relating to the resurrection of the goddess. So the holiday was very easily kind of co-opted into the resurrection of Christ, which I think is an interesting little bridge when we talk about interfaith between two different traditions and different customs.
So stay tuned, and we'll be right back with that meditation and magical moment with Christopher.
Great Mother.
Whenever you have need of anything,
once in a month,
and better it be when the moon is full.
Better it be when the moon is full.
Then shall ye gather.
Then shall ye gather in some secret place and adore the queen, who am queen of all witchery.
All witchery.
Who am queen of all witchery. There shall ye gather.
There shall ye gather.
Ye who are
saints
to learn all magic.
Yet have
And thou who thinkest to seek for me,
thou thinkest to seek for me,
your shall avail thee not.
Thy seeking in vain shall avail thee not.
Lest thou knowest the mystery.
All right, well, welcome to our Astara meditation, or our post-spring equinox and pre-Beltane meditation to connect to the rising life force of the goddess, the budding of the flowers, the greening of the earth. The springtime is a time for renewal, new life, the resurrection of the earth. And we also go through processes where we feel like we've been in the darkness of winter and have to renew and resurrect ourselves, the light of the spring. So if you'd like to take this journey with us, start by closing your eyes and breathing in deeply. Relax the muscles in your head and your neck, in your shoulders and your arms. Breathe in and breathe out, relaxing in your chest and your back, your belly, your lower back, to your hips and thighs, down through your knees, waves of relaxation flow. Your calves and shins, ankles and feet, down to the tips of your toes. Relax. As you breathe in and out, open your heart. Feel love and trust beating within your heart. And within your heart, the triple flame of your souls shall guide you and protect you. I'm going to count from 12 to 1. And then 13 to 1 to get you into a deeper meditative state. You can imagine drawing the numbers from 12 to 1 on the screen of your mind, or you can simply just listen to the sound of my voice taking you deeper. And we go from 13 to 1, 12 for the 12 suns, 13 for the 13 moons of the year. Just allow the sound of my voice to take you deeper. Don't worry about visualizing anything. 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. You are now in a meditative state where everything you do is correct and for the good of all involved, harming none. Going deeper, 13, 12, 11, 10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, and 1. You are now at a deeper level where all is possible. In your mind's eye, imagine a great tree, the biggest tree you've ever seen, the tree of the world, cosmic axis, with its branches holding up the starry heavens, its roots digging deep into the underworld. In your mind's eye, you see this tree. The screen that it's on is like a veil to be separated and parted so you can stand before the tree, pass through the veil Stand before the tree. Stand before the tree. Reach out and touch the bark. And we ask as we touch the bark to connect to the goddess of the spring, the goddess of growing things, the goddess of light and life, love and law. Sit down at the base of the tree. Hear the branches rustling over your head. Smell the moist soil where the roots dig in deep. Cool breeze flows across your skin. The sky is bright. It's warm and sunny. And we call forth and ask to visit the great goddess of the spring, the maiden of the spring, known in many ways and many forms. And as if coming out of a cavern or cave built into the roots of the tree, you see a light shining. You turn your head to see the light more clearly, and rising up through the roots is the great lady of the spring, crowned in a wreath of flowers, in green and gold, bright floral colors. A young maiden of the spring rises up. She circles round the tree three times before she comes to you. The maiden of the spring offers her hand to you and lifts you up from the base of the tree. She wants to go wandering in the fields and forests with you. She speaks to you of the growing things, the season of renewal and of life. She points out various plants and trees, birds and animals, insects. She shows them to you. She hopes to open you to their magic. What does she show you? With each step, the sun becomes brighter, the day becomes warmer, and you know she's leading you to the bright fullness of summer. Her path is a winding one, taking you through the green good earth, but eventually it spirals back around to where you began. She brings you back to the world's tree, to the center of the universe. She brings you back and says farewell. And as she wanders off, flowers bloom in her footsteps. Animals gather in her wake. And she leads a troop of nature. Plants, animals, the breeze of the wind, insects, all following her guidance in changing from winter to spring and spring to summer. And eventually, through her walk, she will bring the fall and the winter again. You watch her as she moves off into the distance and know that the cycle of life is renewed and begins again. And you are a part of that cycle. You've been shown new magics, new medicines, new allies, and affirm that you will work with them in the coming seasons to deepen your relationship, to find that place of silence within, and to reach out to the life force all around you. We thank the great goddess of the spring and the sun god overhead, but now we know it's time to say farewell. Farewell to the tree, to this place and time, and step back through the veil that is the screen of your mind, coming back to flesh and blood, breath and bone, coming back and breathing deeply, feeling your fingers and your toes, as we count up from 1 to 13 and 1 to 12, each number awakening you a little bit more, bringing you back to the here and now. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. When you're ready, open your eyes. Bring your hands to your crown, palms facing your crown. Sweep down over your face, or across your chest, down to your belly, down towards the ground, sweeping away all that does not serve. I release all that does not serve my highest good. Repeat the sweeping motion, the words, I am in balance with myself. Repeat it one last time with the words, I am in balance with the universe. Ground yourself as needed, feeling roots from the soles of your feet and the tips of your toes, like a tree anchoring you here. For those who may feel a little lightheaded or energized, you can reach down and touch the floor with your palms. Imagine breathing out any excess energy or charge. And just bring yourself back to normal consciousness and appreciate now the change of the seasons wherever you may be. Blessed be.
We've added to our lineup of lively, thought-provoking shows. Be sure to check out The Amethyst Oracle, Divination with a Queer Twist, featuring Firefly Willow's LIVE favorite, Heisey Lutmers, and his co-host, Charlie Harrington, on the second Tuesday evening each month. More than just a call-in show, Heisey and Charlie will bring a new and unusual perspective to the power and capacities of the Tarot. Also join us for A Shamanic Life, hosted by John Carosella. On the first and third Tuesdays each month at 8 p.m., John will bring together leaders and explorers in neo-shamanism. Practical and practiced, his guests are not just doing shamanism, they're living it. And don't miss What's Your Prescription for Balance with Mildred Lynn McDonald and her co-host, Dr. Glenna Calder, the first Thursday evening of each month. They'll inspire you with the leading trends and best practices of holistic living, alternative medicine, and life coaching. This vibrant duo and their amazing guests will help you energize and balance your life from the top of your head to the tips of your toes. We're excited. Give us a listen as we continue to create new and entertaining ways for you to shine your inner light. Join us at Firefly Willows LIVE Presents for these new shows and our original Sunday morning Firefly Willows LIVE anchor shows.
Hello, dear listeners. This is your astrology update with James Moran for the month of April 2013. And it feels like in order to get an outlook on this month, it may be worth taking a look back, a little retrospective on the crazy month of March. Hopefully you weathered that quite well with all its electric excitement. We had, during the month of March, a couple of very rare alignments of the planets in the sky. We had two yodes, which are a rare configuration where two planets are 60 degrees from each other and a third is 150 degrees from both. And there was two. There have been two in the sky. It's very rare. And they both emphasize Saturn, the privations, deprivations of Saturn. And we could see that in the budgeting conflicts and the tightening of the budget belt around the United States, Cyprus. Definitely that theme was in the news. And then we had Venus and Mars conjoined together with Uranus in Aries. They're both at the beginning of Aries. They're all three at the beginning of Aries. And Uranus is in a square to Pluto at the beginning of Capricorn. That's the Uranus-Pluto square that is with us for this decade. And that's the one of the defining alignments of our era. To describe that one succinctly, I will say Uranus and Pluto together equal the Harlem Shake. If you've ever watched the Harlem Shake videos, they're quite zany and very unexpected. There's usually a scenario in a workplace or, you know, military establishment where one person is dancing, and then as soon as the music kind of reaches its full bore, everybody's dancing. And not only are they dancing, they're dancing like crazy people. They're in costumes. The dance is kind of a libidinal, wild dance of abandon. So that kind of summarizes the Uranus-Pluto square. Uranus being the liberator, Pluto being the libidinal, Uranus being the strange, the unexpected, Pluto being the instinctual impulses. So when Venus and Mars conjoined with Uranus and went square to Pluto, it made March a very electric month, because Venus is love and beauty and pleasure, and Mars is action and energetic force and athleticism and assertiveness and even anger and aggression. We could see Mars and Uranus quite clearly in the actions of Kim Jong-un. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that name correctly, the supreme leader of North Korea. Uranus, because of its association with the new, the young, and also with the rash, we can see Kim Jong-un embodying that quite well. The young leader, the young inexperienced leader who is making a rash kind of war effort attack. Very Mars, that's embodying the Mars archetype of the warrior. Whew, we made it through March. Wow. The outlook for April is quite different. Having gone through March, by the time we get, you know, two-thirds of the way through April, the sun will have gone into Taurus, and all that energy in Aries with Uranus there and Mars and Venus and the sun, Mars, Venus, and the sun will have moved on into Taurus, so the energy will be different. So the electricity of March will move on, transform into something else. We do have at the end of April, April 25th, I believe, a full moon and partial eclipse right on Saturn. So that means the sun is in Taurus, the moon is in Scorpio, and Saturn's in Scorpio. So the moon and Saturn conjoined opposite the sun, creating a full moon situation right on Saturn in Scorpio. Definitely a reality check. So whatever wild ride March was, we may experience the reality check here now at the end of April. And that's kind of what we have to look forward to for this month. That's the big movement of the energies for this month. And then after we get a nice grounding with that full moon, that partial eclipse, we shall see what May brings. So I can be reached at james@jamesmoran.co. I would love to hear your stories of March, if you have any stories of recklessness and love and war, Mars and Venus, or recklessness in love and war. Feel free to email me. I'd love to hear stories. Email me with any questions. Again, I can be reached at james@jamesmoran.co. That's James Moran, MORAN.co, and also on Facebook. If you look up James Moran Astrologer, I will come up. Thank you so much for listening, and have a very nice grounding month of April. Thanks.
Thank you for joining us. This program was brought to you by Firefly Willows LIVE. We hope you enjoyed the show. This is Deb Caracella. Please join us next time on Firefly Willows LIVE for A Shamanic Life with John Caracella, Tuesday evening at 8 p.m.